Okay, again, Hebrews chapter 11 is where we are. We, in our discussion last week, made reference to Abraham. You had covered that quite extensively as Dennis was filling in for me 2 weeks ago. But last week we discussed the examples of Abraham in verse 17 and then Rahab in verse 31 as we correlated the teaching of the book of Hebrews with the teaching of the epistle of James in the second chapter of his epistle, where he approached the idea of justification as being a faith that responds through obedience, whereas the text of Hebrews chapter 11 indicates individuals who respond or whose faith leads to the response. One approaches it. Works is what validates faith. The other, that faith leads to obedience. And the two teach basically the same thing, that justification or being pleasing to God comes as a result of an individual whose faith is sufficient to lead him to do as God would dictate he do. And that's something that I think is the central message here in Hebrews chapter 11. He begins by establishing what faith is. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Then establishes through these various examples that we are given any number of individuals who showed their faith by doing as God required. And then after giving those examples draws the conclusion that as we have this great cloud of witnesses to teach us that we ought to ourselves act in the same way. That we ought to be steadfast in the expression of our faith so that we might be pleasing to God as well. That's the whole point of Hebrews chapter 11. It's an amazing thing to me that individuals today seek to minimize or even exclude the importance of obedience to God because of the Calvinistic philosophies and influences that exist religiously in the world today. Whereas the text perhaps that is most widely applied to the principle of faith or widely known, which is the Hebrews chapter 11. That's what this chapter is all about, is one that expressly establishes the necessity of obedience as a response of faith to God. And we're going to find just another example of this with regard to the parents of Moses and Moses himself as we look in verses 23 through 29 of the text. Now, as you if you have a handout on Hebrews chapter 11, I'll try to make sure that by next week I'm going to try to have both chapters 12 and 13, the handouts prepared so that we'll have the entire set available for you. But we have a number of different I would say somewhat arbitrary divisions that are given to the chapter. Most probably the first one, faith defined in verses 1 through 3, is appropriate. But once you get to verse 4 and go through pretty much the end of the chapter, there's really no reason for division. But we did talk about the early history, having reference to Abel, Enoch, and Noah. Then specifically Abraham and Sarah in verses 8 through 16. And then the patriarchs, having referenced Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph in verses 17 through 22. In verses 23 through 28, we have Moses himself being referred to, although by intimation his parents are referred to within the context as responding by faith as well. And then when you get into verses 30 and go through verse 40, we have what we might express as a litany, a concise listing, some of them not even by name, but just he basically just throws these all in at the end, saying these two, just to kind of indicate just how extensive this example is in the Old Testament. And I think giving rise to the statement in verse 1 that we are surrounded, chapter 12, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. You can go to the Old Testament and find so many examples of individuals, again, who believed God and who responded by obedience because of their faith. And as a result of that, showed themselves to be examples to us. And that's what they serve to be, as examples. Well, Moses is perhaps one of the greatest examples. He is perhaps the most venerated individual in the Old Testament among the Jews. He was the lawgiver, was perhaps the greatest figure in the history of the Jewish nation, universally respected by the Jewish people. And so this example to the Hebrew Christians would have, I think, a very great impact to them. So if you will, read with me, beginning in verse 23, we'll go through verse 29. And it encapsulates some of the major events in the life of Moses. He says, first, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. I used the word intimated a few moments ago. I just want you to note that in verse 23, it's not the faith of Moses that is mentioned here. It's the faith of his parents that's the primary concern here, and what they did with regard to Moses as a child. But after he became of age, verse 24, when he became of age, he refused to be called the sons of Pharaoh's daughter, the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover with the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. And by faith, they, and again, this is not specifically or exclusively referring to Moses, but also the children of Israel on that occasion, as led by Moses. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. And so here we have one, two, three, four, five different points that are made, five different examples in the life of Moses where faith was demonstrated. And what we want to do is just quickly go over the five. And of course, you can read through the entirety of as you go into the Old Testament, read through the entirety of the account of Moses' life, from the point in time where he was born, while the children of Israel were becoming numerous as they made their abode in Egypt, as pilgrims in Egypt. And then, of course, through the entirety of the time after their exodus out of Egypt in the wilderness wanderings, up until the point where they entered into the land of Canaan, the promised land. That pretty much covers the entirety of Moses' life. You'll remember that he was precluded from going into the land of Canaan, the promised land, because of disobedience on his part. It's a kind of interesting thing, just as an aside, how the Bible, even with regard to the heroes of faith, the greatest personages or examples that we find in the Bible, nevertheless reveals their warts, all their imperfections. And I think that is somewhat different than what you see characterized by literature. I mean, you have in the Greeks what we might refer to as tragic flaws. You have individuals of great virtue or excellence who are brought down because of some tragic flaw. That's kind of an invention of Greek literature. But what you find in Scripture, and this I think is an indication of the fact that it's inspired of God and it is true history, is that you have a very realistic portrayal of individuals. You have David, King David, as an example, who was known as a man after God's own heart, who nevertheless was an adulterer, and even, in order to hide his transgression, guilty in his treachery of murder. As he basically led to Uriah's death on the battlefield. So we find in this particular case a realistic portrayal of an individual. He is known as one of the greatest men of the Old Testament, and yet he was guilty of very heinous sins, and that is described. Moses is another example, whether it be his initial... it could be his violent reaction to, though I think his indignation was just. It was a violent reaction as he murdered or killed the Egyptian who was beating the Israelite slave. You have it's not a lack of willingness, but his hesitation when God called him to be the leader of Israel. He didn't want to be the one. He continually talked about his own shortcomings and tried to escape the responsibility initially. And then when he disobeyed God, and the consequence of that disobedience was that he would die rather than enter into the promised land with the rest of that generation. All of these indicate an individual who, though he was great, he was by no means perfect. And the betrayal of Moses is not an idealized betrayal. It's a very straightforward and accurate betrayal of a man who was great and wonderful but not perfect. And I think that serves as a good thing for us to know, because God does not require perfection of us, but what he does do is expect us to do the very best we can and to strive to be as perfect as we possibly can. That's there's a difference between requiring perfection and requiring us to try to be perfect. There's a big difference between the two. And these are individuals who did just that. Now, as we say, there's five things. The first of the five that are mentioned in this text is, again, not a reference specifically to Moses, but of the circumstances surrounding his birth at that point in time. And this is an account that is recorded in the first part of the book of Exodus. You'll remember that a Pharaoh ascended to the throne of Egypt that did not remember Joseph. And as such, because the people were becoming numerous, the people of Israel were becoming so numerous, determined or was concerned that they might become insurrectionist and rebel. And so he basically determined to break their spirit. And among other things, he made their labor much more difficult. He also required that all male children be killed in order to, again, weaken their numbers as well as break their spirit. And the parents of Moses were unwilling to do this. And Moses was a beautiful child. They recognized that he was exceptional at birth, and so instead his parents hid him. And of course, as you remember the story, he was seen by Pharaoh's daughter as he was floated down the Nile, and she took him as his own and raised him, though his mother was allowed to be his nurse. And so you have a duality here where he was raised as a prince of Egypt, but at the same time was taught the history of his people and had an awareness of who he was. All of this came about as a result of the faith of his parents. And what we do need to recognize, though the narrative is rather spare, is the fact that this was a very dangerous thing that they did. Sometimes when we talk about that, we look at it, it's a children's story that we tell in the Bible classes to our young people, our children. But it was a decision with great consequence to the parents. It endangered them as they kept Moses for however long they kept him before they finally floated him down the Nile and placed their trust and faith in God to care for him. But they did it, and as a result of them doing this, we have the greatest personage, the most well-respected individual in the history of Israel, whose life was spared, and great things were done as a result of the faith of his parents. Boy, there are a lot of good applications to be made from that. One of the things that you'll hear from time to time with regard to the issue of abortion. Abortion in our society has become almost a means of birth control. I recognize it's a bit more dire than that, but it is individuals who have unwanted pregnancies, though the law is supposed to be only in the case of the health of the mother being endangered, at least early on, can terminate their pregnancy for any cause and any reason, and often do. They often kill children just as a matter of the fact that it inconveniences them. It's one of the great scourges of our society. But when you think about it from time to time, you think about the potential of lives and productivity lost as a result of abortion. You talk about individuals who are from very difficult childhoods, perhaps who are, because of health, greatly challenged, who nevertheless overcome those things and become great contributors to society. There's a kind of a scenario that supposedly was drawn out in regard to a philosophy class, and the professor was talking to his students about abortion, and he described an individual, a woman, and who had a venereal disease, and if the child were to be born, it would be partially deaf, and all of these kinds of things, and all these struggles that would happen and everything, and asked the question, would you counsel this woman to abort her child? And else the class said yes, and said, he said, basically, congratulations, you just killed Beethoven. And you know, that could be added to time and time and time again with regard to the number of individuals who are killed, the number of individuals who, despite difficult situations in their lives, were very productive. And the loss of life is a tragic thing. It is because of the faith of Moses' parents that this greatest of the Israelites was not killed at birth. Infanticide was not committed against him, but instead he was allowed to live, and as a result of this, the history of the entire Jewish nation was altered and changed as a result of it. And as something to consider, I think, when the discussion of abortion arises. So that's one just kind of an application I wanted to bring out. Secondly, and this is the primary one that I want to make, is how important it is for us as parents to be individuals of faith and to give direction to our children and to be concerned about the welfare, spiritual welfare of our children. And that should impact greatly the way in which we raise them, what our priorities are, the choices that we make, the direction that we take in regard to the parenting of our children, because of what that child might be, and the end of that. And you know, you could give any number of examples. There are plenty of anecdotal examples that we could give. But I know of numerous families to where entire families are Christians because of a single person who took it upon himself to learn God's word and responded to the gospel, and as such had that influence on his family. What if that person had not been raised with those proper ideas, or if his parents had not been faithful. You know, those kinds of things are important applications to make. So I don't, you know, all of these, there are five things that we can, numerous things we can say with each five of these, but I did think it was important to emphasize the faith of the parents. That's what's emphasized here in the first verse, and the impact that had on Moses and future history, and that should be a cautionary tale to the rest of us as we seek to raise our children and maybe assist in the raising of our grandchildren, that they be raised in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, both for their own welfare, but also because of who else they might influence as a result of it. Yes, Dennis.
The fact that these parents are mentioned, like you said, must be very important. Because as he says toward the end of the chapter, there's a lot of examples of faith that you just can't mention because of the second time.
Right.
He definitely mentioned Moses' parents. And it's interesting enough that I thought about the way that the thing I discussed last week, she was never commanded to do anything. Now, the Hebrew wives really set this up for them because they refused to take the lives of these male children. And the reason given is because they feared God. They knew it was going to take a life. The fact that the Hebrew wife would ever help Dr. Bell got that baby, didn't turn that baby in. Now she had the opportunity, and the very same reason she didn't do it. There's no way they could have known that God had a plan to do the baby. So they're giving credit because of faith. The fact is, God had a plan and rewarded her for at least 3 years she was paid a probably pretty good sum of money to take care of her own child.
Right, yeah.
Which is a wonderful thing. But interesting, back to Exodus 2, doesn't he mention Amram at all? This verse definitely tells us Amram takes some of the credit. Another one going on in his house.
Right.
That had known about it, so he was definitely in on it. But it raises an interesting question. They're giving credit for the faith. So even though God's plan, I know this is pushing a little bit, but I don't know what argumentation to be honest. Because God gave them credit for their faith, they had the opportunity to kill that before. They didn't have the opportunity, then he would give them credit.
Yeah, and I think not only opportunity, but it was something obviously that was commonly done, despite the efforts on the part of midwives and such. It was something that was not. I mean, Moses was the exception. I think that's something that's clear in Exodus. But that is the other thing that perhaps we can, of course, there are many occasions here in Hebrews 11 where we can look and say, okay, we attribute this to God's providence. When we talk about providence, there's that full understanding that God had a plan, a design that was in place before the world began. That scheme of redemption was in God's mind, and Moses certainly had a very important part in that. That God's providence is working in these particular instances. God's good purpose with regard to mankind cannot be thwarted by man, no matter what man may strive or try to do. But when you see that thread, that providential thread going throughout Scripture, it is something that certainly builds our own faith. Anybody else with regard to this first verse in 23? Okay, now there is a very simple transition that, as a result of, you'll remember the this occasion where they spared the child and the child was not killed at birth. That as a result of that, in verse 24, and we go down through verse 26 here, we find that there was an impact again upon Israel, because when Moses became of age, and I think the significance there is, from this point on, what we're talking about was because Moses made his own decisions. Now his parents made an initial decision that impacted his life greatly, allowed him to have a life. But now, when Moses became of age, and of course that has reference to this idea when that final decision had to be made is where he was going to cast his lot. We are told here that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So this is an indication of Moses' will and decision that Moses made. What was his choice? Well, verse 25, he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than treasures in Egypt. For he looked to the reward. Now, verses 27 through 29, we find the consequences of that decision. But the decision itself is what's under consideration in these three verses. So let's think about that initial decision that was made by Moses. The contrast is here given between what we might refer to as an initial reward, a physical reward, a temporal reward, and that which is something reserved for later, that is spiritual in nature, that is eternal in nature. That's the decision that every single one of us has to make. And the reason why the way is narrow and the gate is straight that leads to life, and there are few who find it, is because when that decision must be made, too often individuals are enamored with the temporary, temporal, physical reward rather than that which is eternal, spiritual, and reserved. That is, that it's not instant gratification, but rather it is looking for something that is better, but future. That's the same problem we have today. And I want you to just think about what it was that Moses forsook as a result of this decision that he made. He was, again, the prince of Egypt. He was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was an individual who had claim to accession and would have been a very important person in the history of Egypt and through his life, one who would be a ruler of Egypt. So here is a great position of prestige. As a matter of happenstance, a matter of circumstance, he comes to this. And not only that, but Egypt was a great civilization at that time, perhaps the greatest. And when you look at that, you see when we're talking about riches, we're talking about he wouldn't merely have money; he would be rich. I mean, there would be nothing that would be kept from him that he desired. When we consider what it is, and let's just make this comparison: when we consider what it is that Satan has to offer and what God has to offer. This is the basic approach that the devil takes with all of us. What Moses here chooses and the choice that he is required to make here is the same one that we all are required to make. Now, I'm not saying that we have the opportunity to have unlimited riches and position of great power. But that's what Satan entices us with, is the things that that this life has to offer. It may be money, it may be sinful excess, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. Those are the three things that the devil has to offer. What he offers and promises man is by its nature temporary. It's not something that is eternal in nature. It is temporal. All he has to do is, or all he has to offer are the things that this life supplies. And as a result of that they are physical things, physical enticements. And you look at Moses, and this is this example. This is what he the devil had to offer him, the throne of Egypt, the jewels, that the riches that Egypt had to offer. You'll remember that when Jesus was tempted by Satan in the wilderness, that the same types of things were offered to him. All the nations of the world would be his if he would simply bow down and worship Satan. And so all of these things were offered to Jesus as well. And there's, a very real parallel there. But what Moses chose instead led to a life of deprivation. First of all, as a result of the choice that he made, he had to leave Egypt. He had to leave all those neat things that he had, because he had chosen in this moment's time as he struck down the Egyptian, cast his lot with the people of God, and because of that, he endangered his own life. He had to flee. So he spent a time in exile, but when he returned to challenge the authority of the Pharaoh and to put himself and his people in danger as he followed God. And the consequence of that, though God's providence allowed them to gain their escape from Egypt and gain their liberty, was a generation wandered in the wilderness, you'll remember, for 40 years. And so what the choices that Moses made led him to spend a long period of time in exile, and then as he became the leader of the people of God, to spend the rest of his life wandering in the Judean wilderness. And I've been there. It's not a nice place to live. When you think about wilderness, when we're talking about the American wilderness, we're talking about a lot of trees. When you're talking about the Judean wilderness, you're talking about basically nothing. I mean, it's just some rock out there and dust in the desert, and that's all there is. And it was not an easy existence for that generation. Moses did not make the promised land in the sense of the land of Canaan, but he did make the promised land with regard to heaven, and that's where his focus was. That's where his reward was. Now, what does that teach us? Well, it teaches us that we must make a decision ourselves as to what we're going to embrace and to strive for as we live on this earth. Are we going to try to get those things that are temporal and physical and temporary, or are we going to strive for those things that are heavenly and that are spiritual and that are eternal? Because you have to recognize you can't have both. You can't serve both God and mammon. If you love the world, you make yourself an enemy of God. God demands that we make a choice. Now, that's not to say that an individual, upon choosing to be a Christian, is going to be destitute. But it does indicate that a life that is chosen, if it is a life that is chosen in service to God, is going to be a life of self-denial and a life of struggle and a life of persecution because of the choice that is made. When Jesus told his disciples, he said, "Don't marvel that you are persecuted because they persecute me. A servant is not above his master. If they hate me, they're going to hate you." And we must recognize the same. If we cast our lot with Christ, then as a consequence of that, the world is going to hate us. We have cast our allegiance with another, and as a result of that, we don't fit in anymore. And there are consequences to that. And Moses recognized the consequences, and Moses lived with the consequences of the decision that he made. What I see when I look at this and the choice made is the significance of the choice, certainly, but the consequence of the choice. When you look at it, you say, okay, this is what he had. He had the passing pleasures of sin. He had the prestige of being the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He had the riches and treasures in Egypt. That's what he had. But he put cast his lot with the people of God, and because of that, what did he have? He had, verse 25, he had the affliction of the people of God, but in verse 26, and in verse 26, he had the reproach of Christ. So that's the consequence of it, the reproach of Christ, the afflictions of the people of God. Of course, he had a great reward, an eternal reward in heaven, but that's the reason he made that choice, is because he was willing to give up the temporal as he looked to the heavenly and the eternal. And it's a decision that each and every one of us have to make. You'll remember that Demas was described as being unfaithful to Paul because he said he has left me or forsook me, having loved the present world. Demas desired those things that the world supplied and the world allowed, and his choice in doing so was to forsake Christ, to forsake Paul. We have to make that choice ourselves, and so I think this is where the example and greatest lesson of this particular section is. Verses 24 through 26 is talking about the decision and what motivated Moses with regard to that decision. And it's one that we all must make. All right, any comments, questions about that? All right, well then, that's good enough. We'll go on to verse 27, excuse me. Now in verses 27, 28, 29, we find three of the consequences of what happened as a result of the decision that was made. First of all, in verse 27, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So here, as a result of the decision that he's made, Egypt was out of the question. Egypt was no longer a palatable or legitimate choice that he had. And as a result of that, the wrath of the king, the Pharaoh, and of course that wrath was very great. Again, I would just remind you, when he presented himself before Pharaoh with the instructions of God, and as those 10 plagues were visited upon Egypt, Moses had reason to fear the wrath of the king. When you've got someone like the Pharaoh of Egypt who's angry at you, and the term wrath there is indicative not only of mere anger, but anger that includes resolve. Wrath includes violence in its term. That he was certainly in danger as a result of this, and in danger of the people of Israel as well by what he did. But the choice was made, and as a result of that, he forsook Egypt. And notice the reason for it, because he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Him who is invisible. I want you to remember in that previous verse, in verse 26, the statement is made that he esteemed the reproach of Christ. Now the Christ, of course, had not yet come. He lived and died in faith, not having seen the promises. But this is the end of this process, and this is where the redemption comes. All men are saved as a result of Christ's death on the cross. And he cast his lot there. He made his choice with that regard. Well, that was something that was yet future. It was something that could be described in the text as something that was invisible. The reward, the consequences were great, but the reward, though it was something that was not tangible, it was something that he in faith accepted. He knew the promises of God and knew that he would receive it. And as a result of that, he made that choice. But again, here's this, you heard the phrase, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And what that means basically is if you've got something in your hand, though, the value, if you were to put this aside, you got one bird or two birds. Someone says, okay, well, two birds are more valuable than one bird. Well, that may be so, but you've got this one bird. You don't have those two birds. Those two birds are over there. And if you give this one up and go get the two, they may fly away before you get them. You see, you may not get them. You may be left with nothing. That's the point of this. That's why that statement is made. That's why a bird in the hand is more valuable. But it's not necessarily true. It's certainly not true with regard to spiritual things. Because what he said, okay, I've got Egypt now. But over there on that side, there's something that I'm not going to get in my lifetime. It's not here right now. But God has promised me that I'll attain it. It's not visible. It's not tacit. It's not there yet. But it's out there because God has told me it is. So do I take this that I have, or do I give that up for something that I'll not attain at all in my lifetime, but just as a promise, an esoteric promise, an invisible promise that is out there? Which do I choose? You know, most people say, well, a bird in hand is better than two in the bush. You know, I'm going to take this. But Moses didn't, because he understood, no, there's more value to that which is before. But the other thing, not just more value, but the fact that where this bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, the reason why is because as you reach for the bush, they may fly away and you may not get anything. Moses understood and by faith recognized that if he reached for that heavenly reward, that he would get it. Well, how did he know that? Because God had promised it. It was based upon the faithfulness of God. And that's why it has more value. And that's the same assurance that we have. Yes, we can choose this life and we know what we get. But brethren, we can know what we get later. It's not something that is present. It is something that is yet future. It's not something that we can see. But God's the one that promised it. And since he promised it, there's no doubt about that. The value is there. The possession is there. We can get it. All we have to do is decide to give this up in order to obtain it. And so, in that sense, the two in the bush are more valuable because we can be assured of the fact that we will attain what it is that God has promised us. And that's exactly what Moses believed and understood. And as a result of that, he was willing to forsake Egypt. He wasn't willing to forsake Egypt just in case he might get that. He forsook Egypt because he knew that God had promised him that and that he would attain. And that's the attitude that we ought to have. And that is certainly something that will be impactful to our faith and our Christian life if we accept and understand the faithfulness of God and the surety of what he has promised to us.
The bird in hand, it did fly away, right?
Do what?
The bird in hand did fly away.
Well, once he let it go, it certainly
right.
did. Sure. And for that entirety of his life, he had nothing, but he attained his reward after life was over. So, and then that's the promise that we have as well. Okay, second point, verse 28. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Now this, of course, is referencing the 10th and final plague upon Egypt. But you'll remember, with regard to the plague that was visited upon Egypt in this final case, the reason why Israel was spared with regard to the death of the firstborn of all Egypt is because Israel kept the commands of God. God had given the command that this Passover be observed and that the blood of the sacrificed lamb be put over the doorway of the homes of the Israelites. And that when that messenger of death came and was visited upon the land, causing the death of the firstborn of all Egypt, that the firstborn of the houses of Israel would be spared. Now, again, wonderful, wonderful applications could be made with regard to this. We have a situation where Moses believed. Well, what did this faith of Moses cause him to do? Conditions were placed upon the salvation of the firstborn. Now, this is a point that I'm going to make. So we've got a little bit of foreshadowing here. One of the primary points I'm going to make in the lesson that I'm going to preach this morning. When you have, for example, in Acts chapter 2 and verse 38, the statement, repent, be baptized for the remission of sins. The remitting of the sins of man is something that God does. God has done this, has chosen to do this, to take away the sins of mankind. But because God chooses to do this, and he is the only one that is capable of doing it, he has the right to place conditions upon that act. In other words, God says, I will remit your sins if you will do this or that. There are certain things that God requires. I will save your children from this plague, the death of the firstborn, if you will do this or that. God placed those conditions. Now, if they had not acceded to and submitted to the conditions that God had placed upon them, would the children of the Israelites have been spared? Obviously not. But because they did that, because Moses, we're told in verse 28, kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, when that great plague visited Egypt, and the wailing and the mourning, which was so great in the land, was heard because as they saw the firstborn, all the firstborn of Egypt were dead, the Israelites did not suffer that loss because they did what God told them to do. So this is, again, the response of faith. Faith led them to obey, and as a result of their obedience to the commands of God, which is what faith, or at least acceptable faith, is defined as. Individuals who accept and who respond to those conditions of God. Believe what God says. Believe His promises. Believe His commands. Do as God necessitates that they do. As a result of that, they were spared. And so this, again, is a wonderful example to us. When you contemplate the consequence of this, and you think about it, well, can you imagine Moses giving instructions to the people and Moses saying, what you have to do is you have to keep this Passover feast, and then what you have to do is you have to take the blood of this animal and you have to paint your door jamb with the blood of this animal. And if you don't do that, your firstborn child is going to die. That son of yours is going to die. Do you think any of them would have quibbled with Moses and said, wait a minute, Moses, why, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to do that. That's absurd. I refuse to do that. There's a principle of, and based upon some principle, I'm just not going to do it. No, they didn't. Whatever it takes to save my firstborn child, I'm going to do that. My son, I want him to live. So it doesn't matter what it may seem to me to be, whether absurd or silly or too much, I'm going to do it. And yet with regard to their eternal salvation, the same thing happens today. What must we do, the Jews on Pentecost said. Told, repent and be baptized. Well, baptism? That's absurd. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to do that. God is the one who sets the conditions. God is the one who says, if you want this, then you must do this. And it amazes me that people are willing to quibble, and people are willing to risk their standing with God, who want to argue the point when it's so clearly made in Scripture. When it's not just the death of the firstborn, but the eternal welfare of a man's soul that's at stake. And yet that is done every single day. That's a more important thing even than the physical death, the salvation of the soul. And the conditions are established very clearly. And if we truly believe, then we're going to respond in faith to what God requires. All right? Anybody else with regard to verse 28? And then finally, verse 29, the last verse in this section, we're told by faith, they, and of course it has reference to the Israelites, after they had the 10 plagues visited upon Egypt, finally Pharaoh said, go, and they went, and then you'll remember Pharaoh pursued them. And there was grumbling and mumbling at the very beginning with some of the Israelites, but Moses led them out of the land of Egypt, led them across the Red Sea, and you'll remember in that account that there was that great pillar of fire that was between them and the Egyptians, and the wind blew, and it made the sea dry, and they crossed over on foot. And so they there indicated in verse 29 are the children of Israel. They passed through the Red Sea. They passed through the Red Sea as by dry land. They did it by faith. They believed. And again, can you imagine? You know, someone says, well, it wasn't that deep, or wasn't that big a deal, or, you know, they try to minimize it. Here was a sea, and there was water there, and there was water on both sides after the sea parted, and they had to go down into the sea, walk across the sea, come up the other side. I don't know how far it was. I don't know how deep the water was. But I do know as they were walking in that sea, they looked to one side and looked to the other, and there was water there. A wall of water was there. And they walked through the other side. They had faith. It would take faith to walk down into that and to cross over it. But they believed in God. And as a result of that, God saved them. As a result of that response, what would have happened if someone would have stood there on the shore and said, I'm not going in there. I'm not going to do that. You'll remember after they passed through, the Egyptians followed them into that. If they had remained on the other side, they would have never escaped Pharaoh and his soldiers. But they went through by dry land, and then the Egyptians, this is in contrast, the Egyptians who did not have faith in Jehovah, when they attempted to do so, they were drowned as a result of that. God punished them because of their lack of faith, and they were drowned. And that, again, you say, wait a minute, because of their lack of faith? That's the point made here. The Israelites had faith. They believed Jehovah. They passed through on dry land. The Egyptians did not believe in God. And when they tried to follow them, and can you imagine the same thing? I don't know what it is that's keeping this water up, but Pharaoh says to go get them, so let's go. And they went in, and when they went in, the water came down and they were drowned. And it was faith. The difference was faith. The difference between the Israelites and the Egyptians that let the Israelites pass by and come out the other side, where the Egyptians were drowned, is faith. That's the difference. And so, just as faith saved the Israelites, faith saves us today. they figured out once we made a mistake. That's for sure.
Yeah, sure.
Anybody else? Yes, Nick.
Of course, this incident here is called the baptism of Moses, where they had the water on each side and the cloud above.
And
referred to as later on in the scriptures as being the baptism of Moses.
Yeah. And again, it's an interesting illustration that could be used with regard to baptism being immersion, the whelming and covering of an individual. Alright, I understand passed through this fairly quickly, but we spent now over a month, I think, in chapter 11. So what we'll try to do, as the Hebrew writer concisely gives a listing, in the final verses, beginning in verse 30 and going through verse 40 of the text, we're going to try to be concise with ours as well. So I would like, if possible, for us to finish, the 11th chapter next week. We'll just give some quick explanations and points to be made with regard to these final verses. Spend a little bit of time, especially in verses 39 and 40 of the text, and then we'll pick up with chapter 12 next time. But I appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. I appreciate the fact that you're here, and we'll pick up there next week.